Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This afternoon, we're continuing on with Senate Bill 5545, Oregon Department of Transportation. Representing Legislative Fiscal Office is Susie Jordan and cohort. Linda Schar is our committee, subcommittee assistant today and clerk for this particular session. We welcome Senator Rick Metzger with us today. He'd like to make a short line presentation.
Short line.
Oh, okay.
Very short.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 14, and thank you, Senator Yee, for alerting me about your discussion with the transportation budget. And just wanted to give you a heads up. I know Senator Clarno, who's been working on this as well, is aware of this, but we are working in Senate Transportation on a what I think I would characterize as a revolving fund for short line railroads in Oregon. You'll be hearing about that more. And so we won't go into the details now, but I'll give you a heads up. It's Senate Bill 7223, and the people behind me are working on language to make some revisions in that. But to suffice it to say, Mr. Chair, that there's some real opportunities out there for economic development in rural Oregon, which is my emphasis. I spent a lot of time in Coquille this last summer and Coos Bay and some other places. And some of the reasons for that, it really helped understand some of the needs these folks have in Astoria, even in my area of Mount Hood. And there are some tremendous federal opportunities that these short lines have, not only in getting trucks off the road, but also enhancing their economic development. And they can do it not through the grants of the state of Oregon, but providing security deposits for federal loans to these railroads. And it's a great economic opportunity. It's leveraging very, very few dollars for a lot of possibilities for these railroads across the state. And I know Claudia Howes and others will be talking to you who really understand some of those needs of these short lines. But that bill will be coming to you at some point. Right now we're targeting a $2 million fiscal, that would provide these loans on a revolving basis. And part of our discussion will be to, if you agree with the policies that we move from the Transportation Department, would be to look at, you know, how those dollars might become funded and where they may be transferred from or whatever to meet the need, if you see, as we do in transportation, that this is a real win-win situation for what we're trying to do. So I just wanted to alert you to that, and that bill will probably be coming to your subcommittee within a matter of a few weeks.
Thank you very much. Senator Yee is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think
don't give me details now, Senator Yee, because I don't have it in front of me.
I think short line rail service is very beneficial for small businesses and rural communities. This is detail. Do you have the, do you know what is the match of state funds versus federal funds?
Well, there's different federal programs. Ones that were brought to our attention, so this is only one subset, is the RIF program is with the Central Oregon and Coos Railroad. Mount Hood Railroad is also is one that would benefit from that. In this particular part, and again, this is just a subset of other ones that short lines have available to them. They require roughly a 10% security, a loan security deposit. And so, for example, to improve the line from Eugene to Coquille, which is one of the ones that I saw, in which the port of Coos Bay has invested in the railroad bridge, and the company has invested in their part of the track, and now trying to move up to the 25 mile an hour to maintain the products out of there. They're looking for $6 million from the federal government to upgrade their track. And what the federal government, it's kind of like mortgage insurance, if you know, and that's basically what it is. What they would require is roughly 10% security deposit in order to make the loan. So that's what part of this fund is, how I envision it would be. So the state would make a loan of $600,000 to the railroad to give to the government as a security deposit, and then the government gives them the $6 million, the hard cash, the $6 million, to actually do the improvements. And it's a security deposit, and but they don't, you know, they don't have the cash to put up for that type of a deposit. So under that circumstance, it's 10 to 1, but sometime, and I do say this is a long time down the road, you know, that security deposit, unless they go totally bankrupt, would then be repaid. But it allows them to leverage the federal dollars. And what is wonderful about that program, and there are some others as well, is that it puts you in a situation where it's not apple pie. In other words, the loan has to be made, has to be approved by the federal government. Say we're going to give you $6 million before they're going to ask for the security deposit. So it's a sure thing, and that's why I think it has a lot of great possibilities. But it allows them to provide the security deposit that they don't have the cash to do. But it's not actually a fund for the project. It's just to make sure for loan repayment that the state is saying, yeah, we think this is a worthy project too. Go ahead and give them the money.
Follow up, Senator Yee.
But who pays back the $6 million?
Well, once the loan is paid off, and forgive me because I know Claudia and these people reading all this stuff a lot better than I do, and I'll be honest about that. But the way it has been portrayed to us is that after the loan is paid off, and everything goes according to contract, then that security deposit would be refunded, and that refund to the company would then come back to the state.
But the Mr. Chairman, the railroad companies paid the short line services paid back the $6 million.
Yes, that's between them and the federal government. So, in this particular program, which would be one, and we've talked with Ms. Howells about expanding this for other types of federal programs, which I think is a good idea. The state's involvement would simply be providing the security deposit, which also would be refunded once the federal government refunded that security deposit upon completion of the agreement of the loan repayment.
Just one question in that regard. Number one, these are true loans from the federal government.
Yes.
I hear you saying. And does each loan stand on its own, Senator Metzger?
Well,
help me, Claude. You know these programs so much better, so I don't want to give a wrong answer, because otherwise my answer is I don't know.
Please.
Don't mind, Ms. Chair.
Please.
Chair Butler, I'm Claudia Howells. I manage the ODOT's rail division. You know, we're not sure yet. This is the first round of loans that have gone into the federal government. The FRA has yet to, in fact, make a loan. There, I think, is still some discussion in Washington about whether these loans go in as a group, so that you're actually putting money in to cover the cohorts within that group. It's redundant, but within that loan pot, or whether they'll take each one of them separately. They began thinking that they would go in as groups, but then as of last week, they were actually looking at them being separate standalone loans, which actually reduces our risk, because if there are, 20 different loans from all over the country, conceivably we lose control over the risk. But it would appear that the FRA and the Office of Budget and Management, who really governs this kind of thing at the federal level, are drifting towards the notion of individual loans.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And perhaps as we get a little further into that, we'll have some better information as well. Other questions for Senator Metzger? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
For honoring us by coming today. Appreciate it. Let's see. Some of the folks that had asked questions are not yet here. Can we just proceed with, we'll bypass the questions and answers right now, if that's all right, and proceed with a detailed budget overview of the Budget Transit Division, Public Transit Division, Martin Loring and Linda Gilbert. And what page are we from at this point? We won't even count any of the FRAs and those other acronyms.
I was noticing that.
Against the rail division just yet. Our piggy bank right now is in the vault. It should be open most any time.
It's
a Times vault, and it's not.
Page 30, Mr. Chair.
Page 30.
Good afternoon, Chair Butler, subcommittee members, committee staff. I'm Martin Loring, manager of the Public Transit Division within the Oregon Department of Transportation. We will be starting roughly on page 29 of the Ways and Means presentation packet. Mike admonished me that I'm supposed to bring additional equipment for this presentation.
Yes, the big advantage is for all of the acronyms that you'd like to use.
This imposes an exceedingly hard burden, but we'll try to get through it, Chair. But
well, we've purchased such things as ODOT and STIP and DMV.
Excellent.
Okay. You have free passes on those.
Before beginning my formal presentation, I would like to touch briefly upon a few topics that have come up in questions asked about public transit during the two agency overview sessions and yesterday's public hearing. The first had to do with vehicle ownership. Currently, there are about 400 vehicles purchased with division grant assistance providing rides to Oregon's elderly and disabled residents throughout the state. This fleet is growing to about 700 vehicles. As vehicles purchased with the new Oregon Transportation Network assistance that you provided in the 99 legislative session, as those resources, or as vehicles ordered to be paid for where those resources are received and put in service, this budget will further increase that fleet. What is in common is that ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, does not buy these vehicles and turn them over to transportation providers. Neither does the department own them. Vehicles are acquired by grantees pursuant to procurement requirements of the federal and state government. Many of them are acquired through price agreements established through an open competitive bidding process managed by the Department of Administrative Services. Others are purchased through similar arrangements entered into by transit districts and other local governments. The role of the Transit Division staff is to review grant applications, negotiate grant agreements, process payment requests from transportation providers. Staff also provide technical assistance in the development of state and local bid specifications. The precise question of how we assure that a grant to purchase a vehicle was actually used for that purpose is easy to answer. For vehicle purchase grants, we pay on an invoice after the vehicle has been delivered, inspected, certified to meet all applicable requirements, and payment of the local matching share of the grant has been documented. Ownership is handled in a couple of ways. Most commonly, the transportation provider delivering the service owns the vehicle. In some cases, what are known as governing bodies, I'll define what that term means later, governing bodies, either a county government or a transportation district, will own the vehicles and then lease them out to transportation providers. Again, what is true in all cases is that ODOT does not own them. However, what may have confused the situation is the fact that we do retain physical possession of the certificate of title issued by the Driver and Motor Vehicles Division. And the Public Transit Division is listed on that title as the primary security interest holder. This is exactly the same situation that you and I encounter when we buy a new vehicle with bank financing. And it serves exactly the same purpose. That is, documenting this lien prevents a transportation provider from selling, transferring, or borrowing against the value of this vehicle acquired with grant assistance without the division's knowledge and consent. Vehicle disposal is handled differently under state and federal programs. In fact, this is an area, an innovation where we gained some efficiency this biennium. We worked with the Department of Justice and we found out that for vehicles purchased with federal grant assistance, we can sign them over to the local provider when the vehicle exceeds useful life standards. So this allows them to use that vehicle as a trade-in on new vehicles. It might allow them to sell a lift-equipped vehicle to someone in a local community that needs such a vehicle, whereas state vehicles must be disposed, or state vehicles funded with state grant assistance must be disposed of through the state surplus property system.
Sure.
Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you. Does ODOT participate at all when the vehicles are disposed of by a local jurisdiction? Do you do anything to assure maximum value?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, this change in practice is very new, and I'm not aware of any dispositions that have happened under the new policy, but the short answer would be no, we would not participate in that.
So they could be sold for $100 a piece, and if the local jurisdiction thought that that was adequate reimbursement for lift-equipped vans, that would be that?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, that is correct. For a lift-equipped vehicle, that's a vehicle that has over 100,000 miles on it, is over 4 years old. The real market value is unlikely to be $100, but that would be a local decision.
I was trying to state an obvious extreme,
yes,
where the value was not realized, and I was just curious whether or not you participated at all in the oversight of the disposal of the vehicles once they were in the local jurisdiction's hands. And you said no.
That's correct.
Let me just make sure I understand, though, Mr. Loring, the vehicles would probably be owned by either one of two types of entities. They're not owned by the state, but the state's name is on the title for security purposes, for financing purposes, which I assume that keeps us out of the chain of title for liability purposes. But the state probably is either owned by a 501c3, a nonprofit organization, or another municipal organization, such as a county that's involved in, or a city that's involved in providing the special transportation services.
And that's exactly the scenario I'm speaking to.
Right.
That the contractual agreement is between County X and ODOT. County X then has a contractual agreement with a 501c3, and the 501c3 makes the election to dispose of the vehicles. You're saying that the value, the ultimate value realized, is between the 501c3 and County X, and you guys have nothing to do with it.
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, that is correct. And it is the same situation when we dispose of a vehicle through the state surplus property system. We sign the title over to the Department of Administrative Services. It's sold at auction for whatever that vehicle will produce, and the amount varies widely. We receive the grant percentage back. The matching percentage goes back to the local government jurisdiction.
You just made my point, though. When you turn it over to state surplus, pros, professionals that have a great deal of experience in dealing with surplus vehicles are doing the disposal to realize maximum value. My concern is that with no effective oversight, the 501c3 that has a contractual relationship with the local government may not be as expert and may have the opportunity to not realize maximum value for the vehicles, and thereby depriving the system of the value of the vehicles. And by system, I mean the local 501c3 may be required to come up with match. And because there is no oversight, and I'm not blaming you guys, I mean, I'm saying this might be a systemic problem. They just, for lack of oversight, didn't receive maximum value. And that's my concern.
Well taken. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The second topic has to do with audits and oversight. We may have left the impression that all of our grantees are audited annually by the Secretary of State. That is not quite the case. Public transit is audited annually by the Secretary of State as part of the department's audit. This audit covers all of our expenditures, but not the expenditures of our grantees and subgrantees. Additionally, because we are a small division within a large agency, the audit sample may not include many or perhaps not any public transit division transactions. The Secretary of State also conducts special studies and audits. During the current biennium, we participated in one of those special studies, focusing on what is known as the Federal Transit Administration Section 5311 Small City and Rural Program. Additionally, the Federal Transit Administration conducts a state management review of the division every 3 years or so, and the last review was also completed this biennium. Some but not all of our grantees produce annual financial statements and purchase audits from certified public accountants. The lion's share of what we do, 83% of all of our budgeted resources, exist to provide transportation services to the elderly and disabled. One half of our budgeted resources are tied up in one specific state program, the Special Transportation Fund. The statute authorizing the state special transportation fund requires the Department of Transportation to work through 33 governing bodies. These include 23 county governments and 10 mass transit or transit districts. Governing bodies play a very important role in administering special transportation funds. They determine local funding priorities. They apply for all federal grant formula grant funds and contract directly with providers for their use. Additionally, all special transportation fund grant payments are made through the governing bodies, and these governing bodies assure the Department of Transportation that all requirements are being met. Now, let's look at those governing bodies for a minute. Each of those governing bodies is either a political subdivision of the state, that is, county government, or a municipal corporation of the state, that is, a special purpose district organized under Oregon law. All are subject to local budgeting law, local government budgeting law, and the Oregon municipal audit law. This means they have to follow exacting rules and procedures and produce an annual opinion audit. While these audits are not done by the Secretary of State, each is required to be submitted to the Secretary of State. Relatively little of the demand-responsive transportation services we provide to the elderly and disabled are provided directly by governing bodies or other public agencies. Most services provided by not-for-profit organizations like those that you heard from yesterday in the public hearing, the Oregon Housing Assistance and Associated Services Program that runs Wheels in the Salem area, Ride Connection Portland, Ride Source in Lane County, plus other area agencies on aging, community action programs, and some private for-profit entities like cab companies. Grantees also include individual senior centers and even some programs where there isn't an entity. An example would be a Department of Human Services program called the Community Partnership Team that encourages the use of volunteers throughout the state. Now, these volunteers do a variety of things. In some counties, they provide transportation services. We might fund a vehicle for the volunteers to use, or we might provide grant assistance to reimburse volunteers for mileage encountered in their own vehicle, but there wouldn't be a direct entity involved. The larger not-for-profit organizations do produce audited financial statements. Smaller entities, like an individual senior center, may not. There isn't a state law or rule that requires audited financial statements for these not-for-profits. The controlling authority in this area really is the Federal Office of Management and Budget, Circular A-133, which requires that if a significant amount of federal funds is involved, the grantee or beneficiary has to have an audited financial statement.
What is the significant level of money?
For the Federal Transit Administration, that level is $300,000 in grant assistance during any one fiscal year. I believe that...
That's per grantee?
Yes, per grantee. And in terms of our transportation assistance programs, relatively few of the over 200 grantees we work with receive more than $300,000 in any one year.
Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to get a sense of system performance. It's been my observation that much of the work that ODOT does is focused on systems, systems of airports, systems of transit, systems of highways. And it seems to me that there may be a state role in the performance of the not-for-profits that are delivering the service. And maybe I'm expecting too much, and I'm perfectly willing to have a dialogue with you about it. But it seems to me if you're aware that a 501c3 that's performing the work is failing to do so in some way. Let's say they're in financial difficulty and they're laying off drivers, and the system is being degraded by taking those buses out, both locally and as it applies to our system. My curiosity is, what's the state's role in responding to that if they see part of the system degrading from the performance of a private not-for-profit contractor?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, the short answer is of course we have a role in ensuring system performance, but the role is limited and supportive. The primary agent of change under the statute is the governing body, the responsible county or transit district. Our role is to support local priorities and solve problems. Under the statute, we have but one hammer. If service is not being provided or a governing body is not meeting the requirements of statute, we can cease to fund that county. but like our sister division that manages highways, when there's a landslide, you try to keep the road open and the cars moving through while you repair the damage. In our case, if rides are being delivered, there's no allegation of fraud or abuse and none suspected, we try our darndest within the limits of our resources to offer a helping hand to solve the problem, to get good management systems in place while the transportation services continue to be provided. Not always an easy role to fill, but that's the way we see our role.
Thank you. I respect that answer.
Satisfactory answer.
Yes, sir.
Representative Johnson. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Warren.
Several good questions were asked about prioritizing service needs. You need to know a couple of things in that area. The first involves the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act, commonly referred to by those who don't have to pay a quarter as the ADA. Almost all of the services you heard people testify about yesterday were what we would call paratransit or demand-responsive services. The film you saw from Wheels was a perfect example of the kind of vehicles and services that are delivered in virtually every county of the state by some 200 providers. That is to say, a vehicle equipped with a wheelchair lift and someone who knows how to work with disabled people to get them properly secured within the vehicle once they're inside, etc. But there are really two types of this service offered. For the 15 or so large agencies that provide fixed route transit service, what most of us think of when we think of transit, the buses that run on a regular schedule down the same set of streets every day or light rail, there are about 15 agencies that provide fixed route transit service. For those, there are very strict, what they call ADA complementary, thank you. ADA complementary paratransit services required. And under that program, what they do is they kind of paint lines on a map. Wherever you have a fixed route system, federal law draws a line 3/4 mile on either side of that route. So you've got this mile and a half swath going various places throughout your community. For people living within that corridor who have a disability, but not just a disability, it has to be a disability, an interference with some essential life function that prevents them from using fixed route transit. You had a great example of that yesterday in Jalene Delani. She's blind, but after consideration it was determined that that disability doesn't prevent her from using the bus, so doggone it, she's got to use the bus. Well, so the first thing about that is that people have to apply. And they go through this eligibility screening, and if they live within that three-quarter of a mile on either side of the transit route swath, and they qualify, federal law says that you may not consider the type of trip in allocating the service. The federal law says further that you cannot plead poverty. It doesn't matter how much that service costs, you have to deliver it. I mean, it seems to defy common sense, but that's the law. You know, somebody calls up, wants to go play bridge with friends on the other side of town. That's just as high a priority as someone who needs to get to a dialysis center. I mean, it makes no sense, but it's the federal requirement. As a result of that requirement, take TriMet as an example. The amount of money they spent in providing paratransit service for the disabled in the greater within the transit district has grown from about $2 million a year before the effect of the Americans with Disabilities Act to about $14 million a year now. A very significant requirement. There are some downsides to that. You heard people yesterday talking about the need for door-through-door assistance for the person that might need some help getting the groceries in the house. Under the ADA, they mandate curb-to-curb service only. So if you need help getting into the building, you can't get it through that ADA comprehensive paratransit service. The other downside of that program is that if you live outside that mandated corridor, it doesn't matter how profound your disability is, you can't use that service. It's simply not available to you. So you find people even living within the corridor who need the door-through-door service or who are frail elderly don't fare well under that system. Those rides cost about $19, $20 apiece. And under the federal law, a transit agency may charge no more than twice the regular fare. In the case of TriMet, I think the all-zone regular fare is about $1.75. So you're looking at, what, $3.50 recovery on a 19 or so dollar trip. As a result, you don't see TriMet advertising the availability of this kind of service or any other transit agency in the state. And it creates a problem for people who need the service. There,
Senator, you recognize?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Looking at the lack of gap service, lack of service from the door to the bus stop, or people who are not on the mandatory corridor, do you have small providers that can provide that kind of service? Because if the large providers cannot do it, there must be small providers that can do that kind of gap service. And maybe the small providers can be more efficient in providing individualized services. I didn't see any small providers coming in to provide input yesterday.
Chair Butler, Senator Yee, the answer is yes. Grant assistance to small providers is really the bread and butter of what we do on a day-to-day basis. There actually were some small providers at the hearing yesterday. They either didn't get a chance to testify or didn't want to. Ralph Jewell from Wheels of Joy, working in this part of the state up the San Juan Canyon, was there, and I saw a few others. But these entities, the smaller providers to which the senator referred, provide paratransit services or demand responsive service, but not necessarily the service mandated by the Americans with Disabilities Act. As such, their priorities for service, how they deliver that service, what sort of advance warning they need, the window of reliability about the time the person will be picked up, all these service design issues are local determinations made at the local level. And therefore, where door through door is needed, they may make a decision to provide that service, and we support that. The point is, I mean, we talked about state versus local. The determination of priorities in the programs dealing with the smaller agencies by and large is not imposed from the state level. Priorities are determined locally. This doesn't result in a perfect system, perfect service delivery system, but we believe, and I think would argue that it is the underlying premise of the state statute in this area, that on average, the closer one moves decision-making to the source of any given problem, the higher the probability that a good decision will be made. Clearly, this is something about which reasonable people can disagree, but it is the operating philosophy of our programs to deliver transportation services to the elderly and disabled.
I didn't hear from any small providers yesterday, and you said there were, but some didn't have a chance to provide input. Maybe next week we can invite some small providers to come in and tell us how they can provide some gap services that cannot be provided by big providers. And another thing is, I think the committee would be interested in hearing some alternatives that are efficient and can provide more services. I understand Sandy provide their own alternative system, and they are able to give 800% more services than what the large providers can do. So I would be interested in hearing what, I hope the chair agrees, that what the Sandy City is able to do with the same amount of money that can provide 800% more services to the citizens.
That's rural Portland, Sandy.
Sandy, uh-huh. So maybe next Tuesday we can give them a chance to provide input during public hearing. Mm-hmm.
Do we have public hearing scheduled for next Tuesday?
We do.
You'll, Senator Yee, you'll see that they're invited, or
I would like
okay.
Mr. Martin to invite them.
Okay.
Chair Butler, Senator, are you happy to do that?
Invite people who can provide some alternative ideas that we can get more bang out of our buck.
Particularly if you can get 800% more bang out of your buck.
Yes.
Finally, Senator Yee asked a couple of questions about science, and Representative Smith asked a question yesterday about what the true need for transportation services would be if we were in utopia. To that tough question, I think we have an okay, but not a great answer. Based upon the work done in 1995 and 1997 as part of the Governor's Oregon Transportation Initiative, and with some confirmation in a 1998 study we did called the Mobility Need Survey, it appears that the current level of resources meets just over half the need for transportation services on the part of our elderly and disabled. That is, the identified need level in 1999 was for about $25 million a year in transportation services. At that time, we were providing about $6 million a year in grant assistance, leaving a $19 million a year gap. With the additional help that you provided us through the Oregon Transportation Network, we've narrowed that gap to about $10 million a year. Having said that, I must admit that the number is not as well informed by science or theory as we would like. As Senator Yee has pointed out, we do need more and better science. The problem for us is that good science is expensive. The Mobility Needs Survey cost us $118,000. The more recent state agency transportation coordination study cost us another $86,000. Yesterday, you heard from Jan Campbell from Portland about some of the most exciting work that's been done recently in this area. And this is a study of what a more precise study of what the needs for transportation services are for various elements of the elderly and disabled community in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. This study cost $204,000. But it does advance the state of our knowledge in this area and represents the next logical step for them and I hope for us. Now, our policy goal is crystal clear. We want to provide elderly and disabled Oregonians with the mobility, the rides, that they need to stay out of expensive institutions as long as possible and live independent, productive lives. This is harder to define operationally in terms of how many rides, how many rides certain people need by age group or type of disability or other population segment. It does look like the Metropolitan Area Study may give us what we need to answer this question more precisely. We are reviewing research done by others and proposing research topics to be done at the national level. We'll also be reviewing the work done in the metropolitan area to see if it makes sense and is affordable to expand statewide. This brings me back to where I was supposed to start. Public transit is the smallest of the transportation department's 9 divisions, and we've been part of the department since 1969. As you heard from Linda Gilbert Mundy, the $36.5 million of resources entrusted to our care is about 2% of the governor's recommended budget of $1.8 million for the department. In terms of staffing, our 13.04 full-time equivalent positions comprise less than 0.3% of the department's 4,743 position workforce. The Public Transit Division budget request before you today is essentially a continuing service level request. There aren't any program option packages because we aren't requesting approval for any new program initiatives, and we aren't requesting not asking for funding increases to existing programs. In fact, as Linda Gilbert also mentioned, the request does include a $921,000, approximately 9.5% reduction in general fund support for the Special Transportation Fund program that the governor regretfully had to include due to a general fund shortfall. Given what I've just said about the needs of Oregon's elderly and disabled residents for transportation assistance, you might ask why we are asking for slightly less than a hold-the-line budget rather than for an increase. The short answer is because we think it is the right thing to do in these times. It wouldn't be fiscally responsible for us to ask for an increase in general fund support or a new source of financial support at this time. For the executive branch of state government, the governor is the final arbiter of how scarce resources should be allocated among competing program requests. He had to make some tough decisions to balance his budget request in the face of reduced general fund revenue. The governor proposes, your job is to dispose. However, you need to know that we both respect and support the governor's decision. Further, we're in the happy circumstance that some of the agencies with which we work are still rolling out services and awaiting delivery vehicles funded by the 99 increases. Therefore, holding the line at approximately the same funding level doesn't do any harm. For us, the glass is definitely 91% full, not 9% empty. Trust me, if the financial climate improves and looks better for the 2003-05 biennium, we will be back asking for resources to meet more of the needs of our elderly and disabled residents for transportation services as part of the next budget request.
Representative Smith is recognized.
Are there federal programs out there that we're not applying for because at this point in time we don't have local dollars to match them?
Chair Butler, Representative Smith, no. Not in this area. Enough about the future. The request before you today is to be allowed to use the existing level of staffing and program resources to address the transportation needs assigned to us by previous legislatures. As you can see on pages 30 and 31 of the presentation, we have organized our efforts along program lines. Governor Kitzhaber reminds us appropriately that as state employees, we need to be problem solvers, not program runners. We try to live these words, but do find it useful to talk in terms of programs. Within public transit, essentially there are five. We've already talked at length about special needs transportation. As I pointed out, some 83% of the budgetary resources are there. In addition, we have about six full-time equivalent staff positions of effort represented in that program. The next largest program is in general public transit. Conceptually, that includes two parts. There's general public in the urban areas, and that we do not currently have a program in that area. We do not participate through the public transit division's budget in replacing buses that are wearing out for TriMet or Salem Area Mass Transit or Lane Transit District, any of the other large transit agencies. However, we do administer a federal program called the Rural and Small City Program that benefits small general public agencies, or small agencies serving the general public. There are currently some 37 agencies receiving grant assistance through this federal program, and that represents about 3 FTE a staff effort. We have a small intercity transportation program. Under the federal law, if there are needs for intercity transportation that aren't being met, 15% of the rural and small city program must be spent on intercity transportation. We have one person working in that area. The grant resources average about $500,000 a year. We also have one person working in the area of transportation demand management or rideshare. There are no grant resources attached to this position. This person works with regions, the 5 ODOT regions around the state, to identify the need for park and ride lots, etc. And some of the regions have invested flexible federal funds in promoting local rideshare operations within their communities. There's one operating in Bend, one in Medford area, one in Salem, Portland, Corvallis, and Albany. And
Representative Ringel is recognized.
I have a question that could be answered later, please, but if I could pose it to you now. I'm curious what can be done to improve the park and ride situation around the west side light rail stops, the next stops.
Chair Butler, Representative Ringel, that is one I'd like to get back to you on.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
The last program area is planning. There's one staff person in this area as well, and she manages just under $1 million worth of grant resources. There is some grant assistance provided for statewide transit planning. There is what's called a modal plan, the Oregon Public Transportation Plan, that exists under the Oregon Transportation Plan to identify where the state wants to go in terms of public transportation. That needs to be updated every 6 years. That planner is involved in that effort. The planner also reviews local transportation systems plans around the state. There's some 240 of those that are required to be produced to look for transit elements, provides guidance for the design manuals. If you're designing a road, you know how to properly consider the need for bus pullouts, et cetera. And then administers federal grant assistance that goes to the four metropolitan planning organizations around the state. Our mission supports the overall mission. You heard Mike in the Mike Marsh in the agency overview talk about the department's mission to provide an efficient, safe transportation system that enhances Oregon's economic competitiveness and livability. The special needs program addresses livability for people who aren't able to use a private or their own vehicle to meet their mobility needs. General public transit contributes to livability as well. So we have a supporting role in the agency's mission. Page 33 gets into goals. They're general and fairly obvious. We want to maximize the number of elderly and disabled residents that are able to live an independent, productive life, minimize premature institutionalization, and of course administer the funds with which we are entrusted in an efficient and effective manner.
One question there, please, Mr. Martin and Mr. Loring, and that is relative to those that live outside of that three-quarter mile corridor on either side of a current public transportation system, transit line, do they receive? How do your program goals address their issues if they live outside of that particular corridor, the mile and a half wide corridor?
Chair Butler, our goal is to meet all of the mobility needs that exist. The only relevance of that three-quarter of a mile boundary has to do with a federal requirement.
Right.
On the transit agency that's operating that fixed route service.
And so
our goal is to meet the mobility needs of everyone wherever they live.
You're jumping, you're filling in between the gaps, if you will, outside of the mile and a half corridor with the other programs that we've talked about here.
Absolutely, Chair Butler. In fact, what we find is some of the providers, you heard from Ride Connection yesterday, which is an umbrella agency that exists in the Portland area involving some 30 transportation providers. You'll find them using our grant resources to provide door-through-door service to people living within that corridor for whom curb-to-curb service just won't work. So
it wasn't clear yesterday. Was there a fee charged for that? Is there a fee for even a partial fee for service?
Chair Butler, there are fees for service. They're established by each of the local agencies. Some have fees, some do not. We run into rule conflicts. One of the other sources of funding available for transportation services is through the Federal Older Americans Act. Any service funded through the Older Americans Act is absolutely prohibited by federal law from charging a fee. So in a case like that, they'll provide a coffee can or something for a donation. But fees are common and they vary with the type of service being provided and the agency providing it.
How much of this resource is provided by the Older Americans Act?
Chair Butler, relatively few. Relatively few of the resources come from there. Most of the Older Americans Act funds in Oregon are going into nutritional assistance and other meeting others of the needs of our elderly and disabled residents.
So by and large, there could be a fee charged.
There could be, yes.
Okay. Is the fee actually commensurate with the service provided?
Chair Butler, no, it does not.
Is it normally?
Chair Butler, I do not have, it varies widely, and I If you'd like information on what the fee structure is, or average or range for the 140-some providers with which we work, I can provide that, but I do not have that information at my fingertips.
Does it support, in your estimation, a third, a half of their organization? Does it provide, short of the transportation, actual capital investment that is being made through the public transportation division, public transit division, does it meet the basic needs we saw on the video yesterday? A couple of drivers that were obviously a portion of some of those public transit needs. Does it more than enough to cover their wages and maybe some gasoline? Or
Chair Butler, the rule of thumb in fixed route transit is that the fare box recovery of somewhere around 30% is pretty decent. My sense is that the fare box recovery for paratransit services is much lower than that. I can come back to you with specific detail.
So fare box recovery in which kind is about 30%?
Fixed route transit.
Fixed route transit.
That means that's considered good.
Representative Johnson, she knows what fixed routes mean, I guess.
Yes, sir, I do.
Fixed route transit.
We're relying on you on this one.
Okay. And that's the high end of that, basically, is that fixed route transit return at 30%. And then the others would be something less than 30%, and those are all other transit systems.
Chair Butler, my understanding is your question relates to the demand-responsive paratransit service.
Right, right. So the other demand-responsive paratransit services, the balance of them would be recovering something less than 30% of their gross expenses.
Yes, Chair Butler. I will research that and get back to you, but that is my understanding.
Thank you. Representative Smith is recognized.
Perhaps I can ask this question before we... And I'm going to sound like Senator Yee here. You've actually rubbed off on me, Senator.
Well, that's pretty good.
When I look at your program goals, one of them is to minimize the number of people prematurely institutionalized due to lack of mobility. The question I have is, how do you know you're providing that service? Or perhaps could you recommend to us that we could take dollars out of folks who are institutionalized, put those dollars into this program, and thereby allow them to stay in their homes?
Chair Butler, Representative
folks
Smith.
Folks that are being institutionalized because they do not have the transit needs that you're providing.
Mobility support, right, is one of the life supports or social supports that a person needs to live independently. What we find, and this is definitely an area where we find that investments in the public transit division budget produce benefits that don't show up. Not only do they not show up in the public transit division budget, they don't show up in the ODOT budget. They may show up in a sister agency, the Department of Human Services, which if that person was premature or was institutionalized this year instead of 3 years from now, might be paying $3,000 a month for some sort of congregate living situation.
Can I rephrase my question?
Follow up, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we coordinating with other state departments to ensure that that the use of dollars... Are we coordinating with other departments to ensure that this is the best use of dollars rather than institutionalizing folks, or vice versa? Would it be better to take some of those institutionalized dollars and put them into this so folks could remain a little longer in their homes?
Chair Butler, Representative Smith, that's a multi-part question. Yeah. Are we coordinating? The answer is a resounding yes. That's one of the things the governor insisted on. I mentioned earlier a study that we completed, State Agency Transportation Coordination Study. That was completed during this biennium. We moved into an implementation phase where the governor, through the the head of the Department of Administrative Services and the heads of five state agencies, Transportation, Department of Human Services, Housing, Veterans Affairs, and Employment, is insisting that we work together much better to coordinate all of the dollars that we're spending. Because one of the things we learned in the study, I mean, the $36 million we have in our budget, where I come from, is pretty good money. Department of Human Services spends more than twice that providing client transportation services.
So
they do it in a different way.
Do you feel confident then if we were to provide the public transit division, particularly special needs transportation, with an additional, and I'm going to make up this number, $1 million, that we couldn't save that $1 million in DHS's budget as part of their institutional?
Chair Butler, Representative Smith, I wish it were so, but the relationships are not that simple. I would not feel comfortable as a state manager saying, take $1 million out of Department of Human Services institutional support budget, even if you could do that. It may be federal funds that you can't touch for this purpose, but let's assume that the dollars are fungible. I wouldn't feel comfortable saying, take $1 million out of their budget and stick it in my budget, because the relationships are not that simple or direct.
Just one last question.
Follow on.
So I'm not sure how you validate the statement that you're minimizing the number of people prematurely institutionalized if additional dollars in your program wouldn't limit the number in another.
Chair Butler, Representative Smith, your point is well taken. That is a very, while it's a policy goal, it's one that's not very easy for us to directly measure.
Trying to get you some more money here.
I appreciate that, sir.
I'll let it go. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as you're talking about coordination, maybe you could give us a little more detail. For example, do you do any coordination with housing?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, yes, we do. In fact, Robert Rapine, the director of the of Oregon's Housing and Community Services Department, is the chair of the state agency head task force that's overseeing this coordination effort, and we're working closely with them. The implementation phase, we are early in the implementation phase, and housing is one of the areas in which we're working. One of the areas where we've had effect is to try to provide or get transit agencies to speak with the housing department more closely, so that when new housing investments are being made and there's land available, affordable land available on a transit line, the investment goes there rather than elsewhere in the community. And Mr. Pine has been, and his staff have been, very responsive to those concerns.
Thank you very much.
Enough on goals.
While you're searching for that next page, is there any quid pro quo? Any exchange of funds there with the Department of Housing?
Chair Butler, no. We've not traded any dollars.
Coordination of efforts to maximize the benefits for those who may be in public housing.
That's correct.
Excellent. Thank you.
And the real challenge for us, and where the real payoff will be if we're clever enough to be successful, is in the area of pupil transportation. One of the things we found is that, you know, for every dollar that we spend on public transportation, Human Services may spend two on client transportation, and Department of Education may spend five or seven on pupil transportation. There are lots of barriers to using yellow school buses to haul the general public, and there are lots of barriers against using transit vehicles to haul school kids. But this is an area that we're actively engaged in. We're meeting with not only the Department of Education, but the School Boards Association to explore areas where we get more out of each dollar invested, regardless of where in the state budget you choose to invest it.
And the Coordination Council? The
State Agency Transportation Coordination Committee.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, Chair Butler, Mr. Rapine chairs that group. It's staffed jointly by the Department of Human Services and the Department of Transportation.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Would you mind providing us a list, the whole committee, a list of who's on that Transportation Coordination Committee? That might be a very useful thing for some of us to know that are worried about transportation coordination issues.
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, it would be my delight to provide that list. I would also suggest you might be interested in the study report that is guiding our implementation. I would be happy to provide that as well if you're interested.
Thank you for offering that.
And that is staffed, you say, by which department?
It's jointly staffed by the Department of Human Services out of the Director's Office and the Department of Transportation. There's one person from the Public Transit Division staff and one person from the Senior and Disabled Services Division of the Department of Human Services that's been tasked to support this effort. They're managed by Luis Caraballo from the Department of Human Services with me supporting him.
Okay. Thank you.
Performance measures has been touched on. Senator Yee had a question about our performance measures in the Public Transit Division, particularly the one dealing with elderly and disabled housing. And I would refer the committee to that yellow-fronted March 8th question packet. The senator asked a very good question about our goals, the target at 7.1. It may not be clear, but these are rides per capita per year. And we've been cruising along at under 4, and we're projecting 7. Why we're doubling is very easy to answer. The resources we've had to invest in transportation services for the elderly and disabled were $5.7 million in 95, $5.77 in 96, $5.9 in 98. We've been cruising a lot under 6 until 99. With the resources you approved through the Oregon Transportation Network, the resources available to invest in elderly and transportation services for the elderly and disabled jumped to $11.8 million in 2000 and $16.3 million in 2001. The 7.1 rides per capita per year represents not a goal so much as the sum of what our grantees told us they would be able to deliver with the resources for which they applied. But as you know, if you look at that very, very much, it's 7.1 per person per year in and of itself doesn't really have much meaning. It's sort of like that average size hat that fits no one. Because who needs just 7.1 rides? They either need a lot more than that or none at all. So that's where the good science that we need comes in, and the kind of study that we already talked about comes in, so that we know that if you're in these sorts of circumstances, this is what you need as lifeline mobility help, and we are working on that. So this just represents what we expect to achieve based on the resources. Right. And the reason that we're seeing that goal in 2003 is because of the lag in buying vehicles. This was a big surprise to me when I came to transit. Some of these small buses take 23, 24 months to deliver once you place an order. None of the vehicles we buy are purchased off the lot. They all are ordered, built to spec, and delivered. So there's a lag time of a few months to many months to finish a procurement and actually get the vehicle.
I need some help understanding that, because in some cases I can understand that you're using highly specialized vehicles that have lift capacity or stuff like that. Are there federal requirements that tell you what kinds of vehicles to buy, or is there any option anywhere through the system where instead of having a bus, for example, you could maybe have a minivan or even a sedan?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, there are guidelines. There aren't federal requirements that we buy certain types of vehicles, but we buy a range of vehicles. A small number of sedans or station wagons are purchased. Now, obviously, these are much easier to acquire than a more expensive vehicle. We do
Most
buy minivans.
Most come off the lot, don't they? A minivan, it would just come off the lot.
They could come off the lot, but the paperwork for a procurement that meets the federal and state requirements, just the paperwork, takes some time. Now you're not talking about years, but you're talking about weeks and in a month or two. But those would come off the lot. But even a plain Jane van, a 15-passenger van, generally, you don't see those on lots. Those are special order vehicles. You want to put a wheelchair lift in it? That's more expensive, takes longer. you want to raise the roof to accommodate people inside, takes longer yet. And these vehicles are in demand, and some manufacturers have significant backlogs.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair? I'm trying to understand what would cause you to make certain vehicle purchasing decisions. What would be the circumstances where you would do a bus rather than a van? I mean, I want to know, is there a matrix that you go through? Do you work with your local jurisdictions to understand what their traffic usage patterns are? Do you give guidance to the not-for-profit that's contracting with the county that maybe they could get by with five sedans instead of one bus? Where does that state-level consultation with your local partners occur?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, that is a very apt description of the kind of process we go through. We work with the locals. Ultimately, the decision on what sort of vehicle they need is a local decision, but we try to help inform that decision by review of their circumstances. And if they can get by with a less expensive vehicle, that is the one we encourage them to buy. The most typical vehicle is what's known as a cutaway. It's a one-ton van chassis with one of these fiberglass bodies. Videotape that you saw from Wheels yesterday, that the vehicle you saw there was a cutaway. It's a ton and a half van chassis with a fiberglass body built on it, a wheelchair lift installed, appropriate tie downs for the chairs installed, and you know, a few other features like that the disabled need.
Follow.
The tie downs for the chairs causes me to think of sort of a remark that you made earlier, and I didn't stop the conversation to ask a question. Do you have a standardization in your shop for the safety training that, let's go back to my example of the 501c3 performing for County X, do you have a standardized curriculum that those drivers are required to go through in order to be drivers, or is that totally local jurisdiction dependent?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, we do not have any training that is required. The Public Transit Division is not a regulatory agency. We don't have authority to mandate standards, but we do, in fact, provide and pay for training in how to operate tie-downs. We do have recommendations on tie-downs, and certain features do have to meet federal standards. There are federal Americans with Disability standards affecting tie-downs. There are standards affecting wheelchair lifts, the design standards, how wide, et cetera.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair? Let me give you a hypothetical and ask what transit's response would be, your shop's response. You get a note from somebody, a letter from somebody who said, rather than using standardized restraints in a van, ropes were used to tie down a wheelchair. That comes to you. What would be your response?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, shock and amazement would be my response.
Beyond that, do you do anything about it?
Yes, we would follow up to find out if someone wants to lodge a complaint under the Americans with Disabilities Act that they have not been handled in a safe and proper manner.
And so you would go to the aggrieved party and ask if they wanted to file a complaint. Do you do any? Let's assume that my hypothetical happened. Do you do any outreach to the 501c3 that's performing the service and say to them, we've gotten this complaint that you were restraining wheelchairs with ropes rather than properly certificated devices?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, yes, of course we do. And as part of that, we try to educate them on what needs to be done, and we also try to educate them on the liability that they've exposed themselves to. The disabled person has administrative remedies through the Federal Transit Administration or the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, and they also have direct access to court with provision for payment of attorney's fees that makes this a relatively attractive area to sue in.
One follow-up on that. We heard yesterday some testimony that the liability insurance that one particular group had acquired had been able to acquire it because of the cooperative nature of some particular community organization, United Way or something like that.
Right.
I'm particularly sensitive to this. I think there's a lot of these organizations that have some rather significant difficulty in obtaining the adequate insurance. Is that causing some loss of service, or is this an area that we even want to explore the possibility of assisting them with?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, the answer is yes. This has come up in the transportation coordination study as a significant barrier to coordination. You'll find an agency that has insurance that covers a particular type of risk, transporting a particular type of client, but bars any other use of that vehicle. Well, where the requirements of insurance mandate an inefficient use of capital resources, there has to be a better way to deal with that problem, and we are exploring that. We're asking the Department of Administrative Services risk management people to help us identify what can be done in that area.
When did you approach them, Mr. Lang? Has it been ongoing, or is it recent?
It's recent, sir.
I see. So they may be able to come back with some resolution to assist us in the financing of this insurance package that enables these providers to be able to provide that service with and still remain insured at a reasonable cost.
Chair Butler, I don't know. We have not asked them to look into the financing of insurance, but rather to help us deal with the lack of insurance as a barrier in some way, to identify coverages that may exist that we don't know about, or maybe to craft new coverages, or to seek help from the industry in making needed coverage more readily available.
Thank you.
Chairman, I have a question on the performance measure. In 1995, your rights per person is 3.8, and you're predicting it goes to 7 rights per person in 2002. And in the meantime, the rights per person has kind of gone down. The lowest was 1998, and it gradually comes up to about 5.2 or 5.5 in 01. And then you predict it will go to 7 in 02. And you say it's because of increase in funding, you anticipate it will go to 7 in 02. But I thought all along we have given you additional funding each year. Can you provide us the information how much additional funding you have received each year since 1995 in state and federal dollars?
Chair Butler, Senator Yee, yes. I have that material with me today, but instead of reading it in the record, maybe I'll produce a little chart and give it to you tomorrow. Would that be acceptable?
Mm-hmm. For increase in tobacco tax dollars and in federal dollars. Is that the state dollars? Did we give you general fund money? Mr. Chairman, follow-up.
Follow-up, mm-hmm. Senator Yee.
So did you get additional general fund in addition to tobacco tax money?
Chair Butler, Senator Yee, we received general fund provide transportation assistance to the elderly and disabled for the first time as a result of action taken by the 1999 legislature. Prior to that, it was cigarette tax only.
And federal dollars.
Yes, and federal dollars. Thank mm-hmm. you. You're absolutely correct. And 1 year before I was employed by the department, there was some court settlement that provided a few dollars that gave a little bit of a bump 1 year. It was gasoline tax overcharge or some court settlement. I don't remember the details, could find out. But by and large, funding for this program area has not increased over time since 95, at either the state or federal level. But I have that detail, and I'd be happy to provide it to you.
Thank you, Senator.
The other performance measures that we use are fairly simple. I mean, a lot of what we do is process paper, grant agreements, requests for funds, payment requests, and we have a customer service standard. And our customer service standard is that we try to process 90% of grant agreements and 90% of payment requests within 30 days, turn them around and either send out that grant agreement for signature or actually send out the payment. 90% within 30 days, 100% within 45 days. We're not hitting that yet, but that is our target. The other area, the performance area we monitor is what we call the fleet condition rating. There are currently about 400 vehicles, 404 to be exact, providing transportation services to Oregon's elderly and disabled residents that were purchased with grant assistance. Before the effects of the Oregon Transportation Network were factored in, 69% of those vehicles were in fair or better condition based on the federal standards having to do with useful life and mileage. And they have standards depending on the type of vehicle. You know, regular sedan, 100,000 miles, 4 years. A big transit bus, 600,000 miles, 12 years, and then everything in between. So based on those standards, before the Oregon Transportation Network, 69% fair or better. Once the investments you approve through the Oregon Transportation Network are in place and all those vehicles are delivered, the fleet serving the needs of the elderly and disabled will consist of almost 700 vehicles, which will be at 81% fair or better condition. Our policy goal is to sustain that fleet at at least 80% fair or better, and that is a performance measure for us. Moving on to administrative costs. Of our $36.5 million budget, just over 0.6% is for our administrative costs, some $222,000. Now that is the cost directly associated with me, as determined by the cost allocation study that the department has done. In addition, we have what are known as program management costs, the costs of staffing and other social and services, supplies, and capital outlay to deliver the program resources. That amounts to some 6.2% of our budget. So that over 93% of all these budgetary resources are special payments going into the hands of the transportation providers, some $34 million. Intergovernmental coordination, we touched on. The most significant milestone there was this transportation coordination study. Efficiencies and cost controls, nothing startling there. I mentioned the change in how we dispose of federal vehicles. That was driven really not by a desire to maximize at disposal, but cost avoidance. What we found is that we were getting some vehicles surplused where the engine was bad or the driveline had fallen out. We'd have to send a low boy to Baker, you know, spend $1,000 for the Department of Administrative Services to go retrieve a vehicle that we'd get $100 salvage value at auction from. We can just leave the vehicle there and let them dispose of it. We'll save money. Under performance measures, that we do relate to benchmarks as secondary links. There are a number of them that are listed in the package. Percentage of seniors living independently. All again, it's hard to directly measure an effort that we make in this division producing a direct and measurable result in terms of that factor. I'm now on page 43. In terms of major accomplishments, dealing with the additional resources you provided us in the 99 legislature was probably our major accomplishment. We approved some 527 projects for $31.9 million worth of new transportation investments. We wrote and processed some 300 grant agreements so far this biennium. We completed the coordination study, published it, and distributed it, or have begun implementation. We printed and disseminated two of the mobility need survey reports. and we've completed the first phase of a project loosely called the Virtual Transportation Network that we hope one day will significantly improve the access of people to information about transportation choices. This is really responsive to a vision that our former director, Grace Cronican, came up with, and I think the term is hers as well. The notion is that one day, any one of us, disabled or able-bodied, will be able to use the computer or a telephone through a 1-800 number or a call center to identify how to get from wherever you are to wherever you want to go. It might be within a community, it might be to an adjoining community, it might be nationally, internationally. But all the transportation links, you know, which bus at what time, to get to the train that leaves at this point to get you to Portland, to get onto light rail out to the airport, all those links will be established. You'll be able to link to identify how to do that, and ideally at some future date, not only plan but book that trip and maybe even pay for it, maybe even have it linked to a third-party payer. So if you're a social service client, you can accomplish that as well and have that third party pay for it. It's a very expansive vision. It's the right vision. It'll take us a long, long time to achieve it. We've accomplished the first step. We hired a consultant, did a study. They produced three reports and have made some recommendations that we'll be shortly considering as to what next steps we might want to pursue that we can afford in that area.
Okay. Representative Marigo?
I just missed what you called that.
Virtual Transportation Network.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative, Senator Yee is recognized.
Thank you. I think that there was a program, a computerized program, that was proposed last session, and about $1.5 million was designated for a starting of that computerized program that helps people who are going on the same route to be connected with each other. I think it's called Jitney. How's that program doing?
Chair Butler, Senator Yee, I know of that program, but it is not a program of the Public Transit Division. I know that we helped that program obtain a federal grant for some seed money. For some reason, they didn't accept that assistance. They turned the grant back. I don't know why exactly. And the last I heard, that program was in the hands of the higher education establishment in Oregon. And in all honesty, I've lost track of it since then and don't really know how it's doing.
Mr. Chairman,
hello.
Maybe this is where some coordination between agencies would help a lot, because I think that program fits into what you're planning to do in computerized services that can provide more rights to more people.
Chair Butler, Senator Yee, we would be happy to coordinate with that program.
And give us a report on that, please.
What's with the Jitney program, Senator?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because it passed last session.
Did we actually fund the Jitneys?
Yes,
did that?
We did.
Chair Butler, Senator Yee, I believe it was part of, was it 5511?
Mm-hmm.
The Easter Basket Bill or whatever it was called, that provided a reservation to the emergency board. And I believe some of that reservation was used, but I don't believe all of it has been used. That program targets, it's certainly related, and that is a very good point, Senator, but it targeted stranger to stranger transportation. You're going to go someplace next week at a certain time, and this enables you to find out that Representative Ringo is also going there and might want to ride along with you. That is certainly part of the answer. The focus of our virtual transportation network is more in terms of, you want to go someplace, you don't want to travel with a stranger, you want to use established public transit systems where the drivers have been trained, they've had background checks, and it's a more establishment-oriented transportation solution. there's no reason why they couldn't work together, and I'd be happy to explore that.
Remember that that was the original concept, was a telephone, I thought it was a telephone arrangement for kind of a telephone dispatch.
Chair Butler, actually, I mean, the inventor of this concept is a person by the name of Robert Behnke, and his concept was to use actually what they call personal digital assistants, Palm Pilots, through the wireless network. And great things are being done in that area, and that could be a link for many people.
Is this a good time to invite him to come and give us a status report of how the program is doing? Because I know we did designate $1.5 million for that pilot project, and it sounds like a very good idea.
Let's go ahead and allow the department to, if they're comfortable in doing so. Excuse me, I honestly don't remember what finally happened to it, though, where it went.
Mr. Chair, the Department of Higher Ed ended up with the resource to coordinate that program. It may be appropriate to have someone from that department come and provide the short
status report.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it vested with the higher ed then?
Yes.
Chair Butler, that brings me to essential packages. Do you cover those in your overview, or do we need to cover them here, Michael?
Okay.
The major one of the essential packages, the major change, and I'm sorry, I'm on page 48. The major change is an $8.6 million technical adjustment to convert the Special Transportation Fund revenue transfer to a special payment. This needs a little bit of explanation. Since the legislature created the Special Transportation Fund program in 1985, historically it's been handled as a revenue transfer. Revenue in from the Department of Revenue transfers out to counties and districts. But yet it was the most significant program that the Public Transit Division had to manage. This always caused a disconnect for me, where someone would ask, what's your budget? It's this number. What do you do? Well, it's this other number. So it seemed more sensible, prove accountability to fully display those dollars within the limitation of the Public Transit Division budget, because that is the work that we do. Right. It does increase the expenditure limitation, but not the number of dollars we expend. It's the same level of resources. It just puts it in a different place within the budget that I think is more accountable to you and the people, and better disclosure. Financial, governor's recommended budget, that's been touched on by Linda Gilbert, and I mentioned it. There's a reduction of $921,009 in general fund from the $9 million included in last biennial budget. That's been discussed. And then finally, financial and or performance audit results. As I alluded to earlier, we did complete a state management review with the Federal Transit Administration in July of 1999. According to their own rules, we're supposed to receive a final report within 30 days. We've not received that report yet, so the federal government must have a different calendar than the one I use. But they did it. We did have an audit, an exit interview, and we were able to identify their areas of concern, and we have addressed all of them. They wanted more field monitoring on our part, and they were right, and we've committed more of our resources to that area. In addition, as I mentioned earlier, the Secretary of State did a special federal compliance audit on our rural and small city grant program. I don't know enough about how they work to know whether we'll even get a report. We don't have one yet. This may just be part of their background work in developing the overall agency audit. And with that, my presentation is concluded. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions the chair or others might have.
Thank you. Are there further questions of Mr. Loring?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that if we haven't heard from the Education Department about the status of the JITNEY program, I also like to hear from the department how they can fit the JITNEY program into computerized services, transit services.
Chair Butler, Senator Yee, be happy to comply.
Thank you very much, Mr. Long. So the report, the FDA report that was due from the federal government in July of 99 is still pending.
Chair Butler, yes.
30 days, I guess. I think I rest my case criticizing the feds yesterday about not wanting to honor the 3-year agreement that they've made with the relatives. The submission was dealing with our farm trucks at this point. So.
Yeah. Sir, I appreciated the vigor of your comments.
You know, with our farm economy collapsing around our ears and sometimes we've gone run off the highways, I get just a little bit exercised, and I apologize. With that, let's see, Linda, you had taken us all the way through the public transit portion yesterday, or day before yesterday, along with the transportation safety consolidated budget. At that point, we probably should come back with the time that we have and just touch base on the handout. Thank you very much, Mr. Lyne. Thank you on the questions that Mike, that you had provided as responses relative to the questions on March 12th.
Mr. Chair, if the members have the executive summary for March 12th, salmon colored one, I'll just briefly go through that and then be open to questions today or tomorrow.
Remember, this is the one we were going to do to defer from the very first of the meeting. So we'd have everyone here later on.
And Mr. Chair, I have an appointment in 5 minutes, so I apologize for ducking out.
Thank you very much.
I'll try to be as quick as I can here. The first question was regarding the STIP, the State Transportation Improvement Program, and the connection with counties and cities. And what this indicates is that we try to work with the counties and cities through the Area Commissions on Transportation in particular to integrate their projects and plans. The local plans are to be consistent with the state transportation system plan, and if there are inconsistencies with the Oregon Highway Plan, we work through the Oregon Transportation Commission to identify those inconsistencies and get a determination for amendment. The second one was regarding the Area Commissions on Transportation and what kind of background we can give on that. For those that were at the tour that you saw a map and some discussion by one of the area managers on that subject, attachments B and C of this packet in the white pages towards the end are a map of the acts, which looks like this, about the fifth page from the end of the Area Commissions on Transportation. And then attachment C is a list of those Area Commissions on Transportation, their charter, their area they cover, membership, and other information. We're open to any questions you might have about those memberships. The third question related to the impact of the Attorney General's letter from counsel to us regarding highway fund use. There's a matrix in your packet that goes through the discussion of each one of those areas that are of concern, in particular the 38 that we had to take action on. It looks like this, and it's about 4 pages into the packet. Again, open to any questions that you have about those as you have time to peruse it, or if you'd like to have more one-on-one to discuss how that came out. The bottom line is that our effort was to continue a legislatively directed program, and that's what our effort in the statutory change that's coming before this session does. Question four related to leveraging federal funds and what's at stake in terms of the amount of match that we have available from the state. We'd like to ask for your indulgence to go another day on working with our federal contacts to make sure that we're clear about what those match issues would be at this point, and we'd like to wait another day if we could.
Mike, I'm wondering relative to question number three, because there appears to be some sensitivity to question number three, I'm wondering if you could maybe present that question number three highlighted
together with the information on over to the House Transportation, so our Transportation Committee, Representative Bruce Starr, if you would please.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to spend more time with Representative Starr. We have presented the matrix and had some discussion, but it sounds like we better have some more, you have some questions there.
Yeah,
okay. We appreciate the heads up. Further questions, Mr. Chair? Number five was relating to the performance measures goals for the future, and we've listed on the fourth page of the salmon-colored information the performance measures goals added on to the measures we discussed the other day, that which were a sampling of measures for the agency as a whole. Each one of them has a target, and then years for into the future to answer the question from Senator Yee and others about what will happen in the future and what the expectation is beyond this current biennium and the coming biennium. Question six related to the responding to the Department of Administrative Services report, specifically Senator Clarno asked about our vehicle accident prevention program, what our statistics show, and the summary there is on page five. The brief summary of it is that we have gone down in our amount of state police citations, the number of vehicle accidents, the total incidents have all gone down. However, the property costs or liability costs on some of those incidents, even though they've gone down in total, they have gone up. The fact that those have gone up has encouraged us to adjust and put more focus on this subject. And we've shifted positions internally to ensure establishment of a risk manager position or a risk coordinator. It's not a management position, but rather a position that manages a program. And to help us ensure an emphasis on this within the agency in terms of both the culture and the performance accountabilities for the agency. So we expect to not only continue the reduction of the incidents and accidents, but also make sure that we're also focusing on those areas that result in increasing costs per incident. And again, open to any questions you would have there. Question seven related to ODOT's use of high-tech measures to prevent overheight accidents. And there are two elements there. One is what we use now in terms of working off the current weigh station pre-clearance systems. And that's the first paragraph of answer there. The second relates to temporary usage of those devices at construction projects where we currently have them on site for three different projects shown on the last page, and the cost for those items, which are $15,000 per unit, to give an indication to the driver and an alert or a way to notify them that they are going to be over the appropriate size for a particular project. We've used this in the past and are using them currently for when a false height is incorporated in a bridge or something else that's temporary. Instead of being an 18-foot clearance bridge or a 21-foot clearance bridge, maybe it's down lower because of some work that's going on a temporary basis. We've used this kind of device to signal to the driver that you're below that level so that they have that kind of warning. We have not used it on a regular basis to put it into standard bridges on an ongoing basis to say this bridge is such and such a height and to warn them. We have used signage for that and view that truckers themselves as being responsible for seeing when it says a 21-foot height bridge and they're coming approaching that they know how high their load is. And so there's a responsibility on them to read that sign and respond. Mr. Chair, that's a quick hit on the questions. I'm sorry I went beyond Representative Ringo's time frame, but a quick hit for you. And if there are other questions an hour later, happy to answer those.
Thank you very much. Senator Yee, I think that question number seven dealt specifically with the issues that you had on a crossing in Albany as well.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just thinking about as a preventive measure because the bridge is old, the one I have in mind, and narrow. So in order to prevent it from accidents and cause a closure of 3 weeks, which reaps havoc for the cities, this will be a good measure to have. But I want to know, Mr. Chairman, why don't you use it as a permanent prevention measure instead of just temporary? Can this be used permanently?
Mr. Chair and Senator Yee, we've used it on a temporary basis when we have a change and the drivers would not necessarily be aware of the change, so that it would be an additional signal in addition to the signage to say, hey, there's a change. You are approaching a bridge in an overheight status and there's going to be a concern. We haven't used it on every bridge because the cost involved, $15,000 a shot, is a significant investment in the cost to ensure that preparation or prevention. What we try to use is appropriate signage to say, these are the heights of the bridges that you're approaching. You're a responsible driver. You need to be aware of the size of your load, both height and width, and to make sure that they react appropriately. Every once in a while, this the bridge that the senator is referring to, there was a problem, but the number of times there are problems like that have not been indicated in the past to be a good return on the investment to put this type of equipment at every one of those locations. Happy to talk with you more about the issue, Senator.
Yeah. Kind of like a reverse Splash Mountain at Disneyland. If you're over this height, you can't ride this.
Yeah, but sometimes the truck drivers, they don't read the advanced warning sign, and if it happens, then it's really disastrous for the area. So have the bridge have to close.
That's a big 10-4-foot, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
Appropriate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Marsh. We'll return to this tomorrow. Let's see. Tomorrow's surgery, right? Lose track of the days here.
You have two meetings tomorrow. Tomorrow afternoon.
At least two.
1 to 3, 3 to 5. I mean, for this committee.
Let's see. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. Thank you very much.
Yes, slave wagon chairman.
We've got so many wonderful things to do, Sammy. And tomorrow I'm not going to have a great big lunch before this meeting either. I'm going to fall off my chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mike. We'll take this up and talk to you tomorrow. Thank you.
Do you need, Chair Butler, do you need a reminder?